worn pair of dungarees my mother hated, and padded off in bare feet, searching for the kitchen. I hadn't eaten in 24 hours, and the roar of my stomach was fast overcoming everything else, even my fear of Eve's pistol. The kitchen was surprisingly clean and bright. The tea kettle had been put on, and the table laid. The Scotsman had tossed his worn jacket over a chair, and stood in equally worn shirt sleeves. "Who are you?" I asked, unable to help my own curiosity.
"Fen Kilgore."
He took down a pan.
"Gardener's man of all work. Well, help yourself to tea."
Curious that he called her just Gardener as though she were a man. Man of all work, I wondered, collecting a chipped mug from beside the sink. Aside from the kitchen, it didn't seem like much work was done around this house. He rummaged in the icebox and came out with eggs, bacon, mushrooms, half a loaf of bread.
"Did you got a good gander at her hands?"
"Yes." The tea was strong and dark, just the way I liked it.
"How much do you think she can do with hands like that?"
I gave a little bark of a laugh. "From what I saw last night, she can cock a pistol and uncork the whiskey just fine."
"She manages those two things. For the rest, she hires me. I run her errands. I collect her post. I drive her when she goes out. I cook a wee bit, though she won't let me tidy up anything more than the kitchen."
He added rashers of bacon to the pan one by one. He was tall, rangy, moving with a casual, loose-jointed grace. Perhaps 29 or 30, with a dark sheen of stubble in need of a razor, and rumpled dark hair that came to his collar and badly needed a barber.
"What are you doing here, miss?"
I hesitated. My mother would have said it was highly improper for a man of all work to be asking questions of a guest. But I wasn't much of a guest, and he had more right to be in this kitchen than I did. "Charlie St. Clair," I said, and as I sipped my tea I gave him an edited version of why I'd landed on Eve's doorstep, and her couch, without things like the screaming and the pistol pressed between my eyes. Not for the first time I wondered just how my life had turned so thoroughly upside down in barely 24 hours.
"Because you followed a ghost all the way from Southampton," Rose whispered. "Because you are a little bit crazy."
"Not crazy," I shot back. "I want to save you. That doesn't make me crazy."
"You want to save everyone, Charlie, my love. Me, James, every stray dog you ever saw in the street when we were little."
"James." I flinched, and the nasty inner voice of my conscience whispered, "Didn't do such a good job of saving him, did you?" I cut that thought off before the inevitable surge of guilt hit, and waited for Eve's man to ask questions because my story was, frankly, bizarre. But he stood silent over the pan, adding mushrooms and a can of beans. I'd never seen a man cook before. My father never so much as spread butter on toast. That was for my mother and me to do. But the Scotsman stood there stirring beans and crisping bacon perfectly deftly, not seeming to mind when the grease leaped out and sizzled on his forearms. "How long have you worked for Eve, Mr. Kilgore?"
4 months.
He started slicing the half loaf of bread. "And before that?" His knife hesitated.
"Royal Artillery, 63rd Anti-Tank Regiment."
"And then to work for Eve, that's a switch." I wondered why he'd paused. Maybe he was ashamed, going from soldiering against Nazis to doing housework for a pistol-wielding madwoman. "How is she?" I trailed off, unsure where my question was going. How was she to work for? How did she get this way? "How did she injure her hands?" I asked finally.
"She's never told me."
He cracked eggs into the pan one by one. My stomach rumbled.
"But I could take a guess."
"What would you guess?"
"That she had every joint of every finger systematically smashed."
I shivered. What kind of accident could do that? Fen Kilgore looked me in the eye for the first time. He had dark eyes under straight black brows, both watchful and remote.
"Who says it was an accident?"
I wrapped my whole, unbroken fingers around my mug. The tea suddenly seemed cold.
"English breakfast."
He lifted the hot pan off the stove, setting it next to the sliced bread.
"I've got a leaky pipe to look at, but help yourself. Just leave plenty for Gardener. She'll come down with a foul headache, and a one-pan breakfast is the best hangover cure in the Isles. Eat it all, and she really will suit you."
He sloped out without another glance. I took a plate and went to the sizzling pan, mouth watering. But as I stared into the delicious mess of eggs and bacon, beans and mushrooms, my stomach suddenly revolted. I clapped a hand over my mouth and turned away from the stove before I vomited all over the best hangover cure in the aisles. I knew what this was, even if I'd never experienced it before. I was still starving, but my stomach was rolling and heaving so hard I couldn't have taken a bite if I'd had Eve's Luger pointed at my head again. This was morning sickness, the first time my little problem had decided to make itself known. I felt sick, in more ways than a rolling stomach. My breath came short and my palms started to sweat. The little problem was 3 months along, but it had never seemed like more than a vague idea. I couldn't feel it, couldn't imagine it, couldn't see any signs of it. It was just something that had barreled down the center of my life like a train. After my parents got involved, it was simply a problem to be X'd out like a bad equation. One little problem plus one trip to Switzerland equaled 0, 0, 0. Very simple. But now it felt like a lot more than a little problem, and not simple at all. "What am I going to do?" I said quietly. It was the first time I'd thought about that question in a long time. Not what I was going to do about Rose, or my parents, or going back to school, but what I was going to do about me. I don't know how long I stood there before an acerbic voice broke my statue pose. "The American invasion is still here, I see." I turned. Eve stood in the doorway in the same print house dress she'd worn last night, her graying hair loose and wild, and her eyes bloodshot. I braced myself, but maybe Mr. Kilgore was right about her forgetting her threats of the previous night, because she seemed less interested in me than in massaging her own temples. "I've got the four horsemen of the apocalypse going hammer and tongs in my skull," she said, "and my mouth tastes like a urinal and cheapstow. Tell me that goddamn Scotsman made breakfast." I waved my hand, stomach still rolling sickly. "The one-pan miracle. Bless him." Eve fished a fork out of a drawer and began eating straight out of the pan. "So you've met Finn. He's a dish, isn't he? If I weren't older than dirt and ugly as sin, I'd climb that like a French Alp." I pushed away from the stove. "I shouldn't have come here. I'm sorry I forced my way in. I'll just go..." "What? Crawl back to my mother, face her fury, take that boat for my appointment? What else was there?" I felt the cotton-thick surge of numbness creeping back over me. I wanted to put my head on Rose's shoulder and close my eyes. I wanted to curl over a toilet and vomit my insides out. I felt so sick and so helpless. Eve mopped up a glob of egg yolk with a hunk of bread. "Sit down, Yank!" That raspy voice had authority, stammer or not. I sat. She swiped her fingers on a dish towel, reached into the pocket of her dress, and fished out a cigarette. She lit up with a long, slow drag. "First fag of the day," she said, exhaling. "Always tastes the best. Almost makes up for the bloody hangover. What was your cousin's name again?"
"Rose."
My heart began to pound.
"Rose Fournier. She..."
"Tell me something," Eve interrupted. "Girls like you have rich mummies and daddies. Why aren't your parents beating the bushes for their little lost lamb of a niece?"
"They tried. They made inquiries."
Even when I was angry with my parents, I knew they'd tried their best. After 2 years of nothing, my father said Rose surely must be dead.
"Sounds like a smart man, your father."
He was. And as a lawyer specializing in international law, he'd known the channels and byways through which to conduct his overseas inquiries. He'd done what he could, but when no one had gotten so much as a telegram from Rose, even me, the one she loved best of our whole family, my father had drawn the logical conclusion that she was dead. I'd been trying to get used to that idea, trying to convince myself, at least until 6 months ago. My big brother came home from Tarawa with only half a leg, and 6 months ago he shot himself. I heard my own voice crack. James and I had never been close when little. I'd just been the younger sister he could bully. But once he grew out of the hair-pulling stage, the teasing gentled. He joked about putting a scare into any boy who came to date me, and I teased him about his terrible haircut once he joined the Marines. He was my brother. I loved him, and my parents thought he hung the moon. And then he was dead, and right around that time Rose started to step out of my memory and into my field of vision.
Every little girl running past turned into Rose at 6 or 8 or 11. Every blonde sauntering ahead of me across a campus green became the older Rose, tall and just beginning to curve. A dozen times a day my heart knocked and then crashed as my memory played merciless tricks. I know it's probably hopeless. I looked Eve in the eye, willing her to understand. I know my cousin is probably... I know what the odds are. Believe me, I could calculate them out to the last decimal. But I have to try. I have to follow every trail to the end, no matter how small. If there's even the faintest possibility she's still out there. I choked up again before I could finish it. I'd lost my brother to this war. If there was even the smallest chance of getting Rose back from oblivion, I had to pursue it. Help me, I repeated to Eve. Please. If I don't look for her, no one else will. Eve exhaled slowly.
And she worked at a restaurant called Le Laitier. Where?
Limoges.
Owned by?
A Monsieur René something. I made some more telephone calls, but no one could find a surname. Her lips thinned, and for a few moments she just stared at nothing, those horrendous fingers curling and flexing at her side. At last she looked at me, her eyes impenetrable as flat glass.
I might be able to help you after all.
Eve's telephone call did not seem to be going well. I could only hear half of the conversation as she shouted into the receiver, pacing up and down the bare hall with her cigarette flicking back and forth, like the tail of an enraged cat. But half the conversation was enough to get the gist.
I don't care what it costs to put a call through to France, you desk-bound secretarial cow. Just put me through.
Who are you trying to reach? I asked for the third time. But she ignored me like she had the first two, and kept on haranguing the operator.
Oh, stop mamming me before you choke on it, and put the call through to the major...
I could still hear her through the panels of the front door as I slipped out of the house. The gray wetness of yesterday had disappeared. London had dressed up today in blue skies and scudding clouds and bright sunshine. I shaded my eyes against the sun, looking for the shape I thought I'd seen on the corner through last night's taxi window. There. One of those bright red phone boxes, so iconically English it looked faintly ridiculous. I aimed for it, stomach rolling again. I'd forced some dry toast down after Eve began her telephone call to this mysterious major, and that had calmed the queasy pangs of my little problem. But this was a different kind of sickness. I had a telephone call of my own to make, and I didn't think it would be any easier than Eve's. A wrangle with the operator, and then another wrangle with the desk clerk at the Dolphin Hotel in Southampton, giving my name. And then...
Charlotte? Allô? Allô?
I pulled the receiver away from my ear and stared at it, suddenly irked. My mother never answered the telephone that way unless there was someone around to hear her. You'd think that with her knocked-up daughter doing an overnight bolt to London, she'd be worrying about something other than impressing the Dolphin's desk clerk. The receiver was still squawking. I put it back to my ear. "Hello, Maman," I said briskly. "I haven't been kidnapped, and I'm clearly not dead. I'm in London, perfectly safe."
"Ma petite, have you gone mad? Disappearing like that, the fright you gave me."
A little sniff, and then a murmured merci. Clearly the desk clerk had offered her a handkerchief to dab her eyes. I doubted very much that her eye makeup ran. Catty of me, perhaps, but I couldn't help it.
"Tell me where you are in London, Charlotte. At once."
"No," I said, and something expanded in my stomach besides the nausea. "I'm sorry, but no."
"Don't be absurd. You have to come home."
"I will," I said, when I found out once and for all what happened to Rose.
"Rose? What in..."
"I'll telephone again soon, I promise." And I replaced the receiver. Finn Kilgore turned to look at me as I came back through Eve's front door, and then the kitchen.
"Hand me a dish towel, miss."
He gestured with his chin, up to his elbows, scrubbing the breakfast pan. That made me stare again. My father thought dirty coffee cups miraculously cleaned themselves.
"She's on another call," Finn said, nodding toward the hall as he took the towel. "Tried to get through to some English officer in France, but he's on holiday. Now she's shouting down that telephone at a woman. They don't ken who."
I hesitated. Mr. Kilgore, you said you were Eve's driver. Could you possibly take me somewhere? I don't know London well enough to walk, and I don't have the fare for a cab. I thought he'd object, considering he didn't know me from Uncle Sam, but he shrugged, scrubbing his hands dry.
I'll pull the car up.
I looked down at my old dungarees and sweater. I'll need to change. By the time I was ready, Finn was standing in the open doorway, tapping his boot as he stared out at the street. He looked back over one lean shoulder as he heard the clack of my heels, and not just one, but both of those straight black brows rose. I didn't mistake it for admiration. The ensemble was the only clean change of clothes I had in my traveling case, and it made me look like a China shepherdess, a fluffy white skirt over layers and layers of crinoline, pink hat with a half veil, spotless gloves, and a tight pink jacket that would have molded to every curve if I'd had a single curve to mold to. I lifted my chin and flicked the silly veil down over my eyes. It's one of the international banks, I said, and handed him an address.
Thank you. Lasses in that many petticoats don't usually bother thanking the driver,
Finn advised, holding the door open so I could walk under his arm and outside. Even in heels, I cleared his elbow without needing to duck. Eve's voice came from the end of the hall as I reached to close the door.
You bat-blind, bloody French cow, don't you dare hang up on me!
I hesitated, wanting to ask her why she was helping me. She'd been dead set against it last night. But I didn't press for details yet, for all that I wanted to shake her bony shoulders till she coughed up what she knew. I didn't dare anger her or put her off, because she knew something. Of that I was certain. So I left her to it and followed Finn outside. The car surprised me. A dark blue convertible with the top pulled up. Old, but buffed, shiny as a new dime. Nice wheels. Eve's?
Mine.
The car didn't match his disreputable stubble and patched elbows. What is it, a Bentley? My father had a Ford, but he liked English cars. And he was always pointing them out whenever we came to Europe.
A Lagonda LG6.
Finn opened the door for me.
Hop in, miss.
I smiled as he took his seat behind the wheel and reached for the gear shift, half buried by my spreading skirts. It was rather nice to be among strangers who didn't know my soiled recent history. I liked looking into someone's eyes and seeing myself reflected as someone who deserved a respectful miss. All I'd seen when I looked into my parents' eyes the past few weeks was horror, disappointment, failure. You are a failure, my nasty inner voice whispered, but I pushed it away, hard. London went by in a blur, gray, cobblestoned, still showing rubble, cracked roofs, and bites taken out of seemingly whole walls. All from the war. And yet it was 1947. I remember my father exhaling contentedly over the newspapers after VE Day, saying,
"Excellent. Now it can all go back to the way it was."
As if roofs and buildings and shattered windows just leapt back into wholeness the day after peace was declared. Finn negotiated the Lagonda through a street so badly holed it looked like a piece of Swiss cheese, and a thought made me look at him curiously. Why does Eve even need a car? With gas as short as it is, wouldn't it be easier to get around by tram?
She doesn't do well with trams.
Why?
I don't know. Trams, confined spaces, crowds. They set her off. She nearly blew up like a grenade last time she took a tram. Shouting and throwing elbows at all those housewives with their shopping.
I shook my head, wondering, and with a rumble the Lagonda pulled up before the imposing marble-fronted bank that was my destination. My face must have betrayed my nervousness, because Finn said rather gently,
"Want an escort, miss?"
I did, but a lurking Scotsman who needed a shave wasn't going to make me look any more respectable, so I shook my head as I swung out of the car. "Thank you." I tried to summon some of my mother's effortless sachet as I crossed the polished marble floor inside the bank. I gave my name and my business, and soon I was being shown into the office of a grandfatherly type in houndstooth check. He glanced up from a chart on which he was scribbling figures.
May I be of assistance, young lady?
I hope so, sir. I smiled, marshaled a little small talk. What's that you're working on? Indicating his chart and its column of numbers.
Percentages, figures, quite dull.
He rose, indicating a chair.
Well, do sit down.
Thank you. I sat, took a breath under my half-veil. I would like to withdraw some money, please. My American grandmother had settled a trust fund on me when she died. Not massive, but a good bit, and I'd been conscientiously adding to it since I was 14, and got my first summer job in my father's office. I'd never touched the account. I had an allowance for college, and that was all I needed. I normally left the passbook tucked into my dresser drawer under my unmentionables, but I tossed it into my traveling case at the last minute when packing for the ocean liner. That same part of me that had packed Eve's address, and the report about Rose's last whereabouts. Not laying plans, exactly, but listening to the little voice that whispered, "You might need these, if you get up the nerve to do what you really want to do." I was glad I'd listened to that voice and included the passbook, because I was flat out of cash. I had no idea why Eve had decided to help me, but I didn't think it was from goodness of heart. I'd cross her palm with silver if that was what it took, and the palm of anyone else who might lead me to Rose. But for that, I needed the silver. So I presented my passbook and identification, and smiled at the banker. Within 10 minutes, I was holding that smile in place only by sheer force of will. "I don't understand," I said for at least the fourth time. "You have proof of my name and age, and there are clearly sufficient funds in the account. So why..."
"Parting with such a large sum, young lady, is not generally done. Such accounts are held to be in trust for your future."
"But it's not just in trust for my future. My own savings are in there.
Perhaps if we could speak with your father."
"He is in New York, and it's not such a large amount." The banker interrupted me again.
"The telephone number for your father's office will suffice. If we might speak to him to gain his consent..."
I interrupted him this time. "You don't need my father's consent. It's my name on the account. It was arranged that I would have access to it when I turned 18, and I'm 19. Pushing my cards at him again. "You don't need anyone's consent but mine." The banker shifted a bit in his leather chair, but the grandfatherly expression never wavered.
"I assure you that something can be arranged if we can just speak with your father."
My teeth gritted as if they had fused. "I would like to make a withdrawal of..."
"I'm sorry, young lady."
I stared at his watch chain and his plump hands, the light shining through the thin spot in his hair. He wasn't even looking at me anymore. He'd pulled his chart back and was scribbling more figures on it, and crossing them out again. It was petty of me, but I reached across the table, slid the chart out from under his hand, and gave the columns of numbers a looking over. Before he could bristle, I took a pencil stub from the edge of the desk, crossed out his figures, and wrote down the correct ones. "You were off by a quarter of a percent," I said, sliding the sheet back. "That's why your balance was coming out wrong. Run it through an adding machine just to be certain, though, since I clearly can't be trusted with money." His smile slipped. I stood, chin raised to the highest "I don't care" setting on the dial, and stormed out into the sunshine. My own money. Not just money I'd inherited, but money I'd earned. And I couldn't get 5 cents of it for myself unless I had my father in tow. It was so utterly unfair, my teeth were still grinding. But I couldn't say I was completely surprised. That's why I had a backup plan. Finn looked up as I hurled myself back into the front seat, shutting about half my skirt in the door. "You look somewhat disreputable, if you'll forgive me for saying so," I said, reopening the door and yanking the rest of my crinoline in. "Are you actually disreputable, Mr. Kilgore, or do you just hate to shave?" He folded the battered paperback he'd been reading.
"Better both."
"Good. I need a pawn shop. Someplace that won't ask too many questions if a girl has something to sell." He stared a moment, then moved the Lagonda back into the noisy London traffic. My American grandmother had left me some money in a trust fund. My French grandmother had had a spectacular double strand of pearls. And before she died, she'd had them divided into 2 single-strand necklaces.
"One for each, for Petite Charlotte and La Belle Rose. I should give them to my daughters, but mon Dieu, how pinch-mouthed your mothers both turned out,"
she'd said with her usual French candor, making us giggle guiltily.
"So you too wear them instead when you get married, mes fleurs, and think of me."
I thought of her, reaching into my purse and fingering the luscious strand of pearls. My little French grandmother, dead long before she ever saw a swastika waving over her beloved Paris. Thank God.
Pardonnez-moi, grand-mère, I thought. I've got no choice.
I couldn't get at my savings, but I could get at my pearls. Because my mother had been quite serious about dragging me to Paris after my appointment, getting new clothes and making calls on old friends, and making it clear we were in Europe for social reasons, nothing scandalous. Hence, pearls. I let myself have one more look at them, the great milky beads with the single square-cut emerald that served as a clasp. And then I stalked into the pawnbroker's shop where Finn had pulled up, laid the pearls down on the counter with a clatter, and said, "What can you offer me?" The pawnbroker's eyes flickered, but he said smoothly,
"You'll have to wait, miss. I'm finishing up some important orders." "Usual trick," Finn murmured,
having unexpectedly followed me in this time.
"Get your impatience or you'll settle for what he offers. You'll be here a spell."
I jutted out my chin. "I'll sit here all day."
"I may just go check on Gardner. The house isn't far from here. You won't scarp it on me, miss."
"You don't have to call me miss, you know. Even if I rather liked it, the formality seems silly. It's not like you're escorting me around Buckingham Palace." He tilted a shoulder and loped out.
"Yes, miss,"
he said just as the door closed. I shook my head, then sat down in an uncomfortable chair with my grandmother's pearls looped through my fingers. And it was a good 30 minutes before the pawnbroker turned his attention and his jeweler's glass to me.
"I'm afraid you've been duped, young lady," he said with a sigh. "Glass pearls. Good glass, but just glass. I could give you a few pounds, I suppose."
"Try again." I knew down to the dime what my necklace was insured for. Mentally, I converted dollars to pounds, added 10%, and named my sum.
"Do you have some provenance? Perhaps a bill of sale?"
His glass flashed at me, and I could see his fingers twitch toward the emerald clasp. I twitched the strand back, and we kept haggling. Another half hour eked grimly by, and he wasn't budging, and my voice rose despite myself. "I will go somewhere else," I snarled finally, but he just smiled, bland.
"You won't get a better offer, miss, not without provenance. Now, if you had your father with you or your husband, someone to give assurances that you had permission to dispose of them."
That again. All the way across the Atlantic, and I was still on my father's strings. I turned my head toward the window to hide my rage, and saw the flash of Rose's blonde head in the passing throng outside. A moment later, I saw it was just a scurrying schoolgirl. "Oh, Rosie," I thought miserably, staring after the girl anyway. "You left your family and went to Limoges. How in God's name did you do it? No one lets girls do anything at all. Not spend our own money, sell our own things, or plan our own lives." I was girding myself for a helpless argument when the shop door banged open, and a woman's voice caroled,
"Charlotte, what on earth? Lord Gill, I told you to wait for me. I suppose you knew it would break my poor old heart parting with my baubles, and thought you'd spare me."
I stared. Eve Gardner came sweeping through the shop, beaming like I was the apple of her eye. She had on the same print house dress she'd worn this morning, wrinkled and threadbare, but she had stockings and a pair of respectable pumps. Her gnarled hands were hidden by darned kid gloves, and she'd tucked her straggling hair up under a vast, once stylish hat, with half an osprey pinned to the crown. She looked, to my utter astonishment, like a lady. An eccentric lady, maybe, but a lady. Leaning discreetly in the doorway with his arms folded across his chest, Finn gave an almost invisible smile.
"Oh, I shall be sorry to part with these," Eve sighed,
patting my pearls like a dog, and turning an aloof smile on the pawnbroker.
"South Sea pearls, you know, from my dearly departed husband."
A handkerchief dabbed to her eye, and it was all I could do to keep my chin from hitting the floor.
"And the emerald, that's from India. Came from Cawnpore, far back in my family, my dear grandfather under under Queen Victoria. Blowing up sepoys and good riddance to the little brown devils."
Her voice dripped Mayfair elegance.
"Now examine that luster under your glass again, and let's hear your real price, my good man."
His eyes were flicking over her meticulously mended gloves. The wobbling osprey. the picture of threadbare gentility, an English lady on hard times, come to pawn her jewels.
Some provenance, madam. Some proof of...
Yes, yes, I've got it here somewhere.
Eve thumped an enormous handbag onto the counter, sending the jeweler's glass scattering.
There. No, that's not it. My eyeglasses, Charlotte.
In your bag, grandmother. I weighed in, finally managing to squeeze some words past my astonishment.
I thought you had them. Do check that bag. No, hold this. Is this it? No, that's the bill for that Chinese shawl. Let me see. Provenance. It must be here.
Pieces of paper cascaded over the pawnbroker's counter. Eve plucked through each one like a magpie, chattering in that immaculate drawl, like she'd just tripped out from tea with the Queen, fumbling for non-existent eyeglasses, holding each scrap of paper painstakingly against the light.
Charlotte, do check your bag again. I am positive you have my eyeglasses.
Ma'am,
the pawnbroker said, clearing his throat as another set of customers came in. Eve took no notice, braying away like a dowager in an Austen novel.
Lud, sir, don't fuss at me. This is it. Yes. No. Well, it's in here somewhere.
Her osprey wobbled dangerously, shedding a little shower of feathers that smelled like mothballs. The pawnbroker tried to move to the next set of customers, but she rapped him on the knuckles with his own glass.
Don't wander off on me, my good man. We're not finished with our business. Charlotte, dear, read this for me, my old eyes.
The customers who'd walked in stood there for a while, then finally wandered back out. I stood there like a bit player in a movie, as the pawnbroker finally gave a little moo of impatience.
Never mind, madam. Provenance is not required. I'm not so little a gentleman that I cannot take the word of so obvious a lady.
Good, Eve said. Let's hear your price.
They wrangled for a while, but I knew who was going to win. A moment later, the defeated pawnbroker was counting a great many crisp banknotes into my hand, and my pearls disappeared behind his counter. We turned to see Finn holding the door with a grin that only showed around his eyes.
My lady, he said, straight-faced.
And Eve swept through like an old duchess, osprey bobbing.
Ah,
she said as the shop doors closed behind us, and the Mayfair drawl was utterly gone from her voice.
I enjoyed that.
She looked entirely different from the drunk old bat of last night, with her teacup of whiskey and her Luger. For that matter, she looked entirely different from the hungover crone of this morning. She looked sober, crisp, savagely entertained, her gray eyes sparkling and her bony shoulders shedding the age and the aura of threadbare gentlewoman, as though it was an inconvenient shawl.
How did you do that? I demanded, still clutching my handful of notes.
Eve Gardner tugged off a glove, revealing that monstrosity of a hand again, and tugged her ever-present cigarettes out of her bag.
People are stupid. Stick a halfway decent story and a random bit of paper under their nose, and with plenty of self-possession one can always get through.
She sounded like she was quoting someone. Always? I parried.
No.
The sparkle disappeared from her eye.
Not always. But this wasn't much of a risk. That pompous arse knew he was getting a bargain. I just made him want to shovel me out of the shop a little faster.
I wondered why her stammer came and went the way it did. She'd conducted that charade in the shop as smooth and cool as cream. And why had she gone through with that charade in the first place? I studied her as she held her cigarette out to Finn, and he struck a match for her.
You don't like me, I said at last.
No,
she said, and gave me that hooded glance again, like an eagle looking down from her eyrie. An amused glance, but I saw no liking there at all, no softness. I didn't care. She might not like me, but she spoke to me like an equal, not a child or a slut. So why did you help me in there? I asked, matching her bluntness. Why are you helping me at all?
How about money?
She looked at my fistful of notes and named a chunk of it that made me gasp.
I can take you to someone who might know something about that cousin of yours, but I'm not doing it for free.
I narrowed my eyes, wishing I didn't feel so short, tucked as I was between the tall Scotsman and the tall Englishwoman. You don't get a penny till you tell me who you were calling this morning.
An English officer currently stationed in Bordeaux, she said without hesitation. We go back 30 years, he and I, but he's on holiday.
So I tried another old acquaintance, a woman who knows a thing or two. I asked her about a restaurant called Le Laitier, and the man who ran it, and she hung up on me. I snored. The bitch knows something. If we go talk to her in person, I'll get it out of her. And if we can't get it out of her, I can certainly get it out of my English officer once he's back from duck hunting in La Marche. So, is that worth a few quid to you? She was asking for a lot more than just a few quid, but I let that go.
Why did your interest prick up when I mentioned Monsieur René?
I shot back instead. How can you know him when we don't even have a last name? Or was it the restaurant's name that hooked you? Eve smiled through a haze of smoke. Fuck off, Yank, she said sweetly. No stammering on that. It wasn't a word I'd ever heard a woman say before Eve Gardner. Finn looked at the sky, carefully blank-faced. All right, I said, and counted banknotes one by one into her hand.
That's only half what I asked.
You'll get the rest after we talk to your friends, I said just as sweetly. Or else you'd probably go on a bender and leave me high and dry.
Probably,
Eve agreed. But I wondered, despite my own words. She wanted something more than my money. I was sure of it. So where do we find this old friend of yours, the woman? I asked as we all squashed into the Lagonda convertible, Finn behind the wheel, Eve in the middle with her arm slung carelessly around his shoulder.
Me squashed up against the door, stuffing the rest of the banknotes into my pocketbook.
Where are we going?
Folkestone.
Eve reached to stop her cigarette out on the dashboard, but Finn snatched it from her and tossed it out the window, glaring.
After Folkestone, France.
Chapter 4. Eve. May 1915. France. That was where Eve would be going to work as a spy. A spy, she thought experimentally, probing the thought the way a child probed the hole left by a missing tooth. Her stomach fluttered, part in nerves and part in excitement. I am to be a spy in France. But before France, Folkestone.
You think I can pluck you out of a file room and drop you straight into enemy territory?
Captain Cameron had said on the train, carrying Eve's stuffed carpet bag for her. It was just a day after he'd recruited her over a pot of tea in that boarding house parlor. She'd have gone with him that night in the clothes she stood up in, hang propriety. But the captain insisted on collecting her very properly the following afternoon, giving her his arm to the station as though they were off on holiday. The only one to see Eve off was the tabby cat, whom she had kissed on the nose and whispered to, "Look to Mrs. Fitz next door. I made her promise to feed you extra scraps while I'm gone."
"Should anyone ask?"
Captain Cameron said as they settled into their empty compartment.
"I am a fond uncle taking my favorite niece to Folkestone for the sun."
He closed the doors firmly, making sure they had the compartment themselves, and did another check for eavesdroppers. Eve tilted her head, surveying his lean face and rumpled tweeds. "Rather young to be my uncle, aren't you?"
"You are 22 and look 16. I am 32 and look 45. I am your Uncle Edward. That's to be our cover, now and in the future."
His real name, she had learned, was Cecil Elmer Cameron. Prep schools, Royal Military Academy, a stint serving in Edinburgh, which must have added the faint Scottish mist to his English voice. Eve knew his public credentials now, listed meticulously when she accepted his offer. The private credentials would be given only as necessary in this very private business. And now she had the first of them, a code name. "Uncle Edward it is." Another flutter rippled through Eve's stomach. "What will my code name be?" She'd read Kipling and Childers and Conan Doyle. Even in silly books like The Scarlet Pimpernel, spies had code names, disguises.
"You will find out."
"Where will I be where will I be going in France?" She no longer minded stuttering in front of him.
"Wait and see. Training first."
He smiled, the lines about his eyes crinkling.
"Careful, Miss Gardner. Your excitement is showing."
Eve smoothed her face into porcelain innocence.
"Better."
Folkestone, a sleepy coastal town before the war. Now a bustling port, ferries crammed with refugees arriving every day. More French and Belgian heard on the docks than English. Captain Cameron didn't speak until they were out of the busy station,
and heading down the boardwalk in some measure of privacy.
"The Folkestone is the first stop from Vlissingen in the Netherlands," he said,
setting their pace to keep well out of earshot of the other strolling couples.
"Part of my job is to see that the refugees are interviewed before they are allowed farther into Britain."
"Looking for people like me?"
"And those like you who work for the other side."
"How many have you found of each?"
6 of one, half a dozen of the other."
"Are there many women?" Eve wanted to know. "Among the recruits?" What did one call them? Apprentice spies? Spies in training? It all sounded absurd. Part of Eve still couldn't believe this was happening at all. "I never thought women would be considered for such a role," she said honestly. Captain Cameron, Uncle Edward, seemed able to hook the truth out of her in odd ways.
He must be a marvel in interrogation, she thought.
He slipped information out of you so gently, you were hardly aware it crossed your lips.
"On the contrary," the captain said. "I like to recruit women. They frequently have the ability to pass unnoticed where a man would be suspected and stopped. I recruited a French woman some months ago."
He gave a sudden fond smile, as if at a particularly good memory.
"Who now manages a network covering more than 100 sources, and makes it look simple. Her reports in artillery positions come so quickly and accurately, we can see them bombed in a matter of days. Quite remarkable. She's the best we have, male or female."
Eve's sense of competition stirred hungrily. "I will be the best." He hailed a cab.
Number 8, the parade.
A shabby little place, not much different from the boarding house where Eve had lived. And the boarding house was probably what this address passed for if neighbors proved curious. But when the captain ushered Eve inside, and she came to stand on the faded parlor rug, it wasn't a starchy old maid with a pinched mouth who greeted her, but a tall major in full uniform. He gave Eve a dubious look, fingering the waxed points of an impressive mustache.
"Very young,"
he disapproved, lifting her up and down.
"Give it a chance," Captain Cameron said mildly. "Miss Evelyn Gardner, meet Major George Allenton. I leave you in his hands."
Eve experienced a moment's fear, seeing Cameron's tweedy back disappear, but she banished it. "I must not fear anything," she reminded herself, "or I will fail." The Major looked unenthusiastic. Eve guessed he did not share Captain Cameron's preference for female recruits.
"The first room on the second floor is yours. Report back here in 15 minutes.
And as easily as that, the secret world opened. The Folkestone course lasted 2 weeks. 2 weeks in stuffy, low-ceilinged rooms with windows sealed against the May warmth. Rooms full of students who did not look like spies, learning strange and sinister things from men who did not look like soldiers. Despite Captain Cameron's recruiting preference, Eve found herself the only woman. The instructors overlooked her, eyes going to the men in the room, before they let Eve answer anything. But that didn't trouble her because it gave her time to evaluate her classmates. Just 4 of them, and how different they were from each other. That was the thing that struck Eve most. Any recruiting poster for the fighting troops showed you a line of identical Tommies, stalwart and sturdy, faceless in their similarity. That was the ideal soldier, a line, a regiment, a battalion of strong men all exactly alike. But a recruitment poster for spies, she realized, would merely show you a line of people, all different, who did not look like spies. There was a burly Belgian with a graying beard, 2 Frenchmen, one with a Lyonnais accent and the other with a limp, and a slender English boy burning with such incandescent hatred for the Huns that he almost glowed. "He won't be any good," Eve judged. No self-control. And she wasn't sure about the limping Frenchman either. His hands balled into fists whenever he encountered the least frustration. The whole course was an exercise in frustration, fiddly skills to be learned with infinite patience. The picking of locks, the writing of codes, and the learning of ciphers. The various types of invisible ink. How it could be made and how it could be read. How to read and draw maps. How to conceal messages. The list went on and on. The Belgian swore softly when they learned how to compile reports on the smallest possible scraps of rice paper, because his huge fists were like hams. But Eve quickly mastered the system of tiny letters, each no bigger than a comma on a typewriter. and her instructor, a lean cockney who had barely looked at her since she arrived, smiled at her work and began to watch her more closely. Just a fortnight, and Eve wondered how much it was possible to change in 2 weeks. Or was it not change, but becoming what she already was? She felt like she was being burned, sloughing away every extraneous layer, every scrap of ballast from mind or body that could possibly weigh her down. Each morning she woke with alacrity, tossing the covers aside and springing from bed, her mind one long, hungry scream for what the day had to offer. She manipulated her fingers around those tiny scraps of paper, those deft manipulations that would persuade a lock to give up its secrets. And she thrilled with more sheer, fierce pleasure the first time she sensed a lock's tumblers click than she had ever felt when a man tried to kiss her. "I was made for this," she thought. "I am Evelyn Gardner, and this is where I belong." Captain Cameron came to see her at the end of the first week.
"How is my pupil?" he asked,
strolling unannounced into the stuffy, makeshift classroom.
"Very well, Uncle Edward," Eve said demurely.
His eyes laughed.
"What's that you're practicing?"
"Hiding messages."
How to swiftly slit a seam on her cuff and poke in a tiny rolled message, and how to quickly pluck it back out. It took speed and deft fingers, but Eve had both. The captain leaned against the edge of the table. He was in uniform today, the first time she'd seen him in khaki, and it suited him.
"How many places can you hide a message? In what you're wearing now?"
"Cuffs, hems, fingertips of a glove," Eve recited. "Pinned into the hair, of course. Rolled around the inside band of a ring, or inside the heel of a shoe.
Better forget that last one. I hear the Fritzes have caught on to the shoe heel trick."
Eve nodded, filing that away. She unrolled her tiny blank message and began swiftly threading it through the hem of her handkerchief instead.
"Your classmates are taking target practice," the captain observed. "Why not you?"
"Major Allenton did not think it necessary."
"Can't see a woman ever being in a position to fire a pistol," had been his words.
And so Eve was left behind while her classmates tramped off to the targets with borrowed Webleys. Only three classmates now. The slender English boy had been deemed unfit, and left weeping and swearing. "Go join the Tommies if you want to fight Germans," Eve thought. Not without sympathy.
"I think you should learn to fire a pistol, Miss Gardner."
"Isn't that going against the Major's orders?"
Cameron and Allenton didn't like each other. Eve had seen that on the first day. Cameron merely said,
"Come with me."
He didn't take Eve to the range, but to a deserted stretch of beach, far down from the bustle of the docks. He set off toward the water, shoulders slinging a knapsack that clinked with every step. And Eve followed, her boots sinking into the sand, and the wind tugging at her neatly rolled hair. The morning was hot, and Eve wished she could take off her jacket, but this tramping off alone to an isolated beach with a man who most certainly wasn't her uncle was already improper enough. Miss Gregson and the rest of the file girls would all think me no better than I should be. Then Eve pushed that thought aside and stripped down to her skirt waist, reasoning that she wouldn't get far as a spy if she thought too much about propriety. The captain found a driftwood log, unpacked a series of empty bottles from his clinking knapsack, and lined them up on the log.
"This will do. Step 10 paces back."
"Shouldn't I be able to shoot from farther than that?"
Eve objected, dropping her jacket on a patch of seagrass.
"If you're taking aim at a man, odds are it's up close."
Captain Cameron paced off the distance, then took his pistol from its holster.
"This is a Luger 9mm P8.
Eve wrinkled her nose. "A German pistol?"
"Don't sneer, Miss Gardner. It's far more accurate and reliable than our English ones. Our lads get the Weebly MK4. That's what your classmates are training with. And they might as well not bother, because you need weeks to get good with a Weebly, the way they jump on firing. With a Luger, you'll be hitting at targets with just a few hours of practice."
Briskly, Captain Cameron broke the pistol apart, named the parts, and had Eve assemble and reassemble it, until she lost her clumsiness. When she caught the trick of it and saw her hands moving with deft speed, she thrilled with the same liquid excitement she'd been feeling ever since she arrived, whenever she managed to decipher a map or decrypt a message. "More," she thought. "Give me more." Cameron had her load and unload, a and Eve could tell he was waiting to see if she'd beg to shoot, and not just fiddle with the pistol's parts. He wants to see if I have patience. She pushed a wind-whipped lock of hair back behind one ear, and took the instruction mutely. I can wait all day, Captain.
There.
At last he pointed to the first of the bottles lined up on the driftwood log.
You have 7 shots. Sight down the barrel so. It doesn't kick like a Weebly, but there's still recoil.
He tapped a finger to her shoulder, her chin, her knuckles, correcting her stance. No attempts to make this intimate. Eve remembered the French boys in Nancy, whenever she appeared on a duck hunt. Let me show you how to aim that. And then they'd start wrapping their arms around her. The captain nodded, stepping back. The stiff salt breeze tugged at his short hair and ruffled the slate blue of the channel water behind him.
Fire!
She emptied out her 7 shots, the reports reverberating around the empty beach, and didn't hit a single bottle. Disappointment stabbed, but she knew better than to show it. She just reloaded.
Why do you want this, Miss Gardner?
The captain asked, and nodded for her to fire again. I want to do my part. She didn't stutter at all. Is that so strange? Last summer when the war began, every young man in England was burning to join the fight, make something of himself. Did anyone ask them why? She lifted the Luger, squeezing off another 7 shots carefully spaced. Clipped one of the bottles this time, sending a chip of glass flying, but didn't shatter it. Another stab of disappointment. But someday I will be the best, she vowed. Even better than your prize recruit in Lille, whoever she is. The captain's voice continued.
Do you hate the Fritzes?
They weren't far from Nancy, where I grew up. Eve began to reload. I didn't hate them then. But they invaded France, tore it to pieces, took everything good about it for themselves. Snapping the last bullet in. What gives them the right?
Nothing.
He studied her.
But I think it's less patriotism with you than the urge to prove yourself capable.
Yes, she admitted, and it felt good. That was what she wanted above all. Wanted it so badly it hurt.
Relax your grip a touch. You're pulling the trigger rather than squeezing it, and it's throwing your aim to the right.
On her 2nd shot, a bottle exploded. Eve grinned.
Don't think of this as a game.
The captain looked down at her.
I see so many young men on fire to beat the German swine. That's all right for the rank and file. They'll lose that illusion the first week in the trenches, and no harm done to anything but their innocence. But spies cannot be on fire for anything. Spies who think it a game will get themselves killed, and likely their fellows as well. The Germans are clever, and they are ruthless, regardless of anything you have heard about the stupid Boche, and from the moment you set foot in France, they will be determined to catch you. As a woman, you might not be stood up against a wall and shot, as happened to a boy of 19 I sent to Roubaix last month. But you could be shoveled off to rot in some German prison, starving slowly among the rats. And no one could help you. Not even me. Do you understand, Evelyn Gardner?
Another test, Eve thought, her heart beating hard. Fail and she'd get nowhere near France. Fail and she went home to a rented room and filing letters. No. But what was the right answer? Captain Cameron waited, eyes steady on hers. I never thought this was a game, Eve said at last. I don't play games. Games are for children, and I may look 16, but I have never been a child. She began to load the pistol again. I can't promise I won't fail, but it won't be because I think it's all a lark. She returned his gaze fiercely, heart still thumping. Was that the right answer? She had no idea, but it was the only one she had.
You will be sent into German-occupied Lille,
Captain Cameron said at last. And Eve's knees nearly buckled in relief.
But you go to Le Havre first, to meet your contact. Your name will be Marguerite Lefrançois. Learn to respond to that name as if it were your own.
Marguerite Lefrançois. In English it would translate to something like Daisy French. And Eve smiled. a perfect name for an innocent girl, a girl to be ignored and talked over, just a harmless little daisy, lurking fresh-faced in the grass. Captain Cameron smiled back.
I thought it would suit.
He pointed at the row of bottles, just six left. He had lean, tanned hands, and Eve saw the gold flash of a wedding ring on the left.
Again.
Bien sûr, Oncle Edouard.
By the end of the afternoon, all the bottles were smashed. With a few more days of practice under his tutelage, she could pick off seven bottles in seven shots.
Making a great deal of time for you, Cameron is,
Major Allenton observed one afternoon, when Eve came back to class after practice. He hadn't bothered speaking to Eve since her arrival, but now he gave her a speculative glance.
Be careful there, my dear.
I can't imagine what you mean. Eve settled back down behind her desk, first to arrive for a practice session on code-breaking. The captain is a perfect gentleman.
Well, not perfect, perhaps. It was that nasty business that sent him to prison for 3 years.
Eve nearly fell out of her seat. Cameron, with his gentlemanly voice lilting its faint hint of Scotland, and his impeccable public school grammar, the mild gaze and lanky grace. Prison? The major fingered his waxed mustache, clearly waiting for her to press for juicy details. Eve straightened her skirts and kept silent.
Fraud,
he said at last, satisfaction evident to be dishing on a subordinate.
If you're curious, his wife tried to claim her pearl necklace had been stolen, which made it insurance fraud and a very dodgy business. He took the blame for her, but who knows what really happened.
The major looked rather pleased at Eve's expression.
Don't suppose he told you about the prison sentence, eh?
A wink.
Or the wife.
Neither, Eve said frostily, is any of my business. And since he was reinstated to His Majesty's army in a position of trust, then it is not my my place to question his authority.
Wouldn't call it a position of trust, my dear. War makes for strange bedfellows. We need all hands on deck, even the soiled ones. Cameron got his pardon and his reinstatement, but that doesn't mean I'd want any girl of mine walking the beach alone with him. Once a man's been behind bars, well.
Eve imagined Cameron's long hands holding the Luger for her. She could not imagine those hands thieving anything.
Will that be all, sir?
She was aching to know more, of course, but she'd be hanged before she asked this spiteful walrus with his ridiculous mustache for another word. The major wandered off, clearly disappointed, and Eve eyed Cameron covertly the following day. But she didn't ask him anything, because everyone in Folkestone had secrets. And on the day the training course ended, he tucked the Luger into her neatly packed carpet bag as a gift, and said,
"You leave for France in the morning."
Part 2 Chapter 5 Charlie May, 1947 I don't know how long the channel crossing took. Time stretched on forever when you spent it vomiting.
Don't shut your eyes.
Finn Kilgore's Scottish burr sounded behind me as I clung grimly to the railing.
Makes your stomach worse if you can't see which direction the swells are coming from.
I screwed my eyes shut tighter. Please don't say that word.
What word?
Swells.
Just look at the horizon and...
Too late, I groaned, and leaned over the railing. I had nothing left to bring up, but my stomach turned itself inside out anyway. Out of the corner of my eye I could see a pair of Frenchmen in dapper suits, wrinkling their noses and edging farther down the deck. A stiff gust of wind whipped across the deck, and my dark green hat, with its horrid rolled brim, went cartwheeling away.
Let it go,
I gasped between heaves as Finn made the swipe over the rail.
I hate that hat.
He smiled, reaching to gather my whipping hair and hold it out of my face as I retched one final time. I'd been hideously embarrassed the first time I vomited in front of him, but now I was too ill for humiliation.
That's a delicate stomach you've got for a yank, he observed. Judging from their hot dogs and their coffee, I thought Americans didn't get sick at anything.
I straightened, probably looking as green as an old can of peas.
Please don't say hot dogs.
He dropped my hair.
As you wish.
We were standing at the opposite end of the boat from Eve, because she'd found my misery enormously amusing, and I'd had to retreat before I killed her. Eventually, Finn had joined me. He must have gotten tired.